Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for April 2015. This is issue number 363 and is the last issue of the DX Audio Service. The address for the DX Audio Service is the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service, Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251. Email address is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. My telephone number will stay the same, which is 419-228-6223, as it's my personal telephone number. The Musings line is now disconnected. Board of Directors have asked not to have their numbers published. It appears now that the Board of Directors for the National Radio Club, in their words, is going to let the DX Audio Service die. So, with heavy heart, this is the last time that we'll be together on this magazine. After this issue is mailed, I'll be taking all the assets of the National Radio Club and shipping them to Wayne Heinen, who will likely disperse them, as the club has no interest in preserving a magazine on CD. And posting on EDXN as well will cease. For those of you that still have issues due, you will be refunded based on the number of issues times $2.50, and you will be sent a check from the National Radio Club's treasury. If you have any problems or concerns with a refund, need CD replacements, you'll have to contact Wayne Heinen in Aurora, Colorado for a resolution. Now here's the AM switch.
Dave Alpert with the April issue of the AM Switch, beginning, as we always do, with call changes. 1110 WWBJ, Martinsburg, Pennsylvania, changes to WJSM, which was their legacy call sign, dropped in 2009. 1120 KEOR, Catoosa, Oklahoma, changed to KETU. This has actually been in effect for a while, but was just reflected in the FCC's database in February, but it says the effective date was November 21st, 2012. 1130 KQRR, Mount Angel, Oregon, is now KXET. And 1150 KXET, Portland, Oregon, changes to KGDD. 1350 WRWR, Warner Robins, Georgia, now uses the call sign WYPZ. 1400 Santa Paula, California, does a flip-flop with another area station and becomes KUNX, while 1520 KUNX Port Hueneme, California, changes to KKZZ. By the way, the 1520 station is silent at last check. And just to keep your history correct, back on February 4th, 1520 KGDD, Oregon City, Oregon, changed to KXET. Then on February 12th became KQRR. 1530, KCMN, Colorado Springs, Colorado, changes their call to KKHI. 1550, WMSK, Morganfield, Kentucky, is now WUCO. And 1560, WQEW, New York City, is now WFME. New Station Watch, the application for the new station on 890 in Anthony, Texas, which has been around since 1985, has finally been dismissed. 1240 KEWE, Kahului, Hawaii, a new station, which is U5, 5 kilowatts day and night, is on the air and has been on with temporary authority for some months now. And the 1490 application for Uncasville, Connecticut, U1, 1,000 watts day and night, has been dismissed. Some new station CPs scheduled to expire in the next few weeks include KSPK 1180, Walsenburg, Colorado, KMCA 1450, Hilo, Hawaii, a construction permit for 1540 in South Chase, Florida, a CP for 1260 in Keauau, Hawaii, and a construction permit for 1010 in Reno, Nevada. Station's going dark, or not. 890 KYWN, Meriden, Idaho. This CP for U1, 50,000 watts day and 125 watts night from their current day site expired, so KYWN remains U2, 50 kilowatts day and 250 watts night from separate day and night sites. 970 WERH, Hamilton, Alabama. The license is canceled per an FCC letter to the station dated February 12th. As we mentioned last issue, this was expected, as the station recently admitted that it had been silent since November 8th, 2012. A station silent for more than 1 year is automatically canceled. 1430 KCRX, Roswell, New Mexico, had its license canceled on October 1st, 2013, when the licensee forgot to file for renewal. KCRX applied for special temporary authorization to broadcast while the license cancellation is appealed, but that application has been dismissed. 1480 WCHZ, Augusta, Georgia. License canceled February 5th with no explanation on the FCC website. 1550 WZRK, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. The law firm representing the station filed a letter asking for the license to be canceled January 15th, and as we mentioned last issue, WZRK was deleted from the FCC database in late January. But on February 9th, the FCC, without explanation, added the station back into the database as an active licensed station. 1570 KBRI, Brinkley, Arkansas, has been silent since October 8, 2013, and has been silent for more than a year, and notified the FCC on February 2nd it does not intend to return to the air in any case, so their license is canceled. Construction permits for existing stations. These CPs are on the air. 970 KCFO, Tulsa, Oklahoma, adjusting their day pattern. 1000 KCEO, Vista, California, their CP for U4 or maybe U5? 10,000 watts day and 900 watts night is on the air. 1400 KPCE, Portsmouth, Virginia, has a CP for a new site that's now on. WPCE stays U1, 1 kilowatt day and night. 1560 WMBH, Joplin, Missouri's CP for U1, 500 watts day, 35 watts night from a new site is now on. And 1580 WLPK, Connersville, Indiana's CP for U1, 245 watts day, 5 watts night is also on the air. CP built and nearing final licensing. 900 KALI, West Covina, California. They applied for a license to cover their CP for U4, 5 kilowatts day, 150 watts night at a new site. Applications for construction permits received. 1450 WASK, Lafayette, Indiana, applies to replace their tower, remaining U1, 1,000 watts day and night. 1550 KDCO, Golden, Colorado, applies for U2, 5,000 watts day, 350 watts night from their existing site. CP expired and deleted. 1150 WDEL, Wilmington, Delaware. That station CP for U4, 10,000 watts day, 5,000 watts night, expired. WDEL remains U4, 5,000 watts day and night. Special Temporary Authority, 930 WMGR, Bainbridge, Georgia, granted an STA with D1, 5,000 watts due to copper theft, which affects their nighttime tower. 960 KALE, Richland, Washington, granted an STA for reduced day power. KALE is emitting spurious signals for unknown reasons, but only when operating with full day power. 1010 WCKW, Garyville, Louisiana, granted special temporary authority with U1, 90 watts day and 42 watts night due to transmitter malfunction. 1080 WHOO, Kissimmee, Florida, applies for an STA with U1, 1500 watts day, 11 watts night from the WAMT 1190 tower. WHOO lost their transmitter site on March 5th. 1380 WELE, Ormond Beach, Florida, granted an STA with U4, 1,000 watts day and night using a backup transmitter. 1440 WWCL, Lehigh Acres, Florida, applies for an STA with U4, 9,900 watts day, 4,700 at night to overcome Cuban interference. This action replaces a previous STA with similar provisions. 1470 WMGG, Dunedin, Florida, granted an STA with U1 750 watts day and 400 watts night from a CP site located in Egypt Lake, Florida. WMGG lost their transmitter site on March 1st. 1460 KARR, Kirkland, Washington, is granted an STA with U1 625 watts day and night from a temporary 65-foot vertical antenna. KARR also lost their licensed transmitter site. 1490 WBVA, Bayside, Virginia, granted an STA with U1 30 watts day and night from a new construction permit site. And 1590 WPUL, South Daytona, Florida, is granted an STA for a temporary site located about 3.3 miles north of their licensed site. They needed to return to the air to maintain their license. Silent stations informing the FCC. They are silent. 630 KIDD, Monterey, California, went silent December 31st. KIDD's owner has sold all other stations and will seek a buyer who can find a new tower site. 860 WOAY, Oak Hill, West Virginia, went silent February 14th due to an electrical hit to the phone lines. We can only presume the phone line is how they got their programming from the studio to the transmitter. 930 WEZZ, Monroeville, Alabama, is silent again as of February 6th to allow the moving of equipment to a new CP site located in Brantley, Alabama, on 920. WEZZ does not plan to return to the air from Monroeville. 940 WNRG, Grundy, Virginia, went silent November 3rd due to transmitter problems and lack of money to fix it. 1240 KRAL, Rollins, Wyoming, is now silent, has been since January 28th because employees resigned and it's too cold to find replacements. Hopefully, after it warms up, they can find some warm bodies to staff the station. 1310 WSLW, White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, silent since February 12th due to a massive transmitter failure. 1360 WGBN, McKeesport, Pennsylvania, went silent August 10th last year, then went back on the air September 1st, and then fell silent again. The FCC just noticed. A little trivia about this station. Rush Limbaugh once worked there as Jeff Christie. 1480 WQTM, Fair Bluff, North Carolina, has been silent since February 18th due to copper theft and other vandalism. And 1460 KARR, Kirkland, Washington, went silent, came back on the air briefly with an STA, but is believed to be off again. These formerly silent stations have informed the FCC they are no longer silent. 580 KZMX, Hot Springs, South Dakota, back on the air as of January 25th. 930 WTOU, Battle Creek, Michigan, off since last July as WBCK, returning to the air January 30th. 1210 WDGR, Dahlonega, Georgia, silent since January 27th of last year, stating their transmitter was smoking. Returned to the air January 25th this year, using 200 watts and hopefully not smoking. 1340 WXKX, Clarksburg, West Virginia, went silent September 7th, 2013, and was back on the air as of January 16th, 2014, but has just now been taken off the FCC silent list. 1480 WQTM, Fair Bluff, North Carolina, went silent April 16, 2014, but returned to the air this February 6th. 1490 KFCR, Custer, South Dakota, off since last February, back on this January 25th. 1490 KRUS, Ruston, Louisiana, went silent November 17th, 2014, and came back on the air at 7 p.m. on February 21st with a new tower. 1590 WPUL, South Daytona, Florida, was silent February 18, 2014, but returned to the air February 10th with an STA. And 1600 WXMY, Saltville, Virginia, silent since February 3rd, citing studio damage in recent rains, is back on the air. Oh, Canada, 810 CJVA, Caraquet, New Brunswick, granted a CP to move to 94.7 megahertz FM, so look for CJVA to be gone from the AM band very soon. And 1350 CIRA 5 Gatineau, Quebec, according to Dan Siss, is off the air and does not plan to return. Our thanks to Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Steve Kennedy, Fred Vobey, David Yokas, John J. Rieger, Bruce Conti, Doug Smith, Ernie Wesolowski, Bill Dvorak, and Tony Fitzherbert. That's the last AM switch here on the DX Audio Service. I'm going to miss having the opportunity to bring it to you, and I want to join everybody else in wishing Fred Vobey all the very best in his future endeavors. With Mark back from the Minnesota Twins preseason and in his Minneapolis studio, that's all from me in Los Angeles. And Mark, I know you have some insight into why we're winding down this service.
Oh gosh, thank you, Dave. I hope this isn't the last time we exchange audio pleasantries across the country, though it is the last time we'll do so in a National Radio Club publication. Yeah, I do have some personal comments just before we tend to bandscan matters for April 15. As you know, the close of the DX Audio Service is not an April Fool's joke, but it's sad to note that it was within the power of the National Radio Club to keep this service on the air. Now, before going any further, I should utter the obligatory disclaimer that the things you hear from my corner of the world do not necessarily reflect the views of the National Radio Club, its directors, or the DX Audio Service publisher, Fred Vobey. Fred has told me he will not edit or alter my remarks, and it is within his power to do so with the electronic razor blade in the Sheetrock Studios. I believe I calculated somewhere that I've been part of the service for 19 of its 30 years. We've brought you band scans from Minneapolis and central Minnesota, with Madison, Wisconsin, aboard a ferry on Lake Michigan, and from the beaches of South Florida. From Nashville, New England, New York, from the Gulf Coast states to Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Wyoming, Kansas, New Mexico, Nebraska, Colorado, Arizona, and of course, the Utah desert. Stops included the Lima, Ohio Sheetrock announce booth. To that, we added Death Valley, Reno, Seattle, and Cincinnati. Over the years, we've brought you Dashboard DX and Backwoods band scans. We scanned the band across Canada and shared our exceptional luck in grabbing what should have been some impossible DX catches. We also did a band scan of the mythical Lake Wobegon. We did market profiles from Dallas in the Southwest, from Los Angeles, the Pacific Northwest, Minneapolis, Omaha, Cleveland, Atlanta, and Miami. We broadcast NRC convention reports and even tried to predict the future of AM radio. Within our 205 band scans, you heard interviews with DXers about the FCC monitoring station, the WLW 500,000-watt operation, the Border Blasters, and the Pavic Museum of Broadcasting. We learned about shortwave, longwave, FCC rules, the NBC chimes, transatlantic broadcasts, radio network recording, and the fun of ultralight DX. In good humor, you endured technical talks on antennas, including those for apartment use, and transmitting towers, how to reduce noise interference, how WWV operates its time signals, and how transmitter towers and beverage antennas work. We heard about nighttime voices on the big powerhouse stations, about the WCBS and KNX tower collapses, and about impactful rulemakings by the FCC. With our radios open, we followed the Missouri River from start to finish, and we followed Highway 50 across America. I remember we brought you several Clear Channel honest-to-goodness shows from WCCO, recordings of the nighttime monitoring of the 1A Clear Channel stations as heard at the other 1A Clears, and we shared an ambitious series of broadcasts on how the AM band was developed. We even had fun with our Guess the DX Location contest and with some irreverent Midsummer Madness broadcasts. All taken, it was a huge number of columns, but it's dwarfed by the efforts of other editors and contributors, and in particular our publisher, Fred Vobey, to whom we all owe a deep amount of gratitude for emphasizing the word service in the DX Audio Service. Former band scanner Jim Snowbarger puts it best.
And also thanks to Fred for bringing the DX Audio Service to press every single month through personal trial and difficulty and near death, as a matter of fact. Fred dragged himself into the studio and did it. And I think we all owe him a debt of gratitude for that. I know how much you appreciate the DXAS showing up in your door every month. So make sure that Fred and the other editors know that.
And it's precisely because of Fred's 30 years of selfless contribution that we find ourselves in this pickle today. Because Fred told me he would have continued the DXAS under NRC were it not for the increasing problems he encountered in seeking top-level support from the club. Now, some of you may not be aware, but there's a lack of respect for the blind community among one or two club leaders. Some of you have experienced firsthand the effects of what I'm talking about in dealing with subscription issues. Others are sadly no longer in our audience because they felt they weren't being dealt with respectfully, and so they voted with their wallets. Now, please don't read between the lines. The problems weren't all on the club. Some issues dealing with subscriptions could have been handled better by all of us. And to the extent that we as a DX Audio Service volunteer group may have failed you, we apologize. But some of the problems were due to increasing resistance when Fred has asked for support from the club administration. The tone of some responses to him might in fact cause anyone to question whether it was worthwhile to keep going. It appears the time has now arrived when Fred answers that question. His thinking is, you know, I'm happy and gratified to produce this service, but after all the production hours in the Sheetrock announce booth, I don't have the additional energy needed to deal with club managers. In fact, their positive support of our work should be a no-brainer. Well, that's my interpretation of what Fred has said anyway. Here he is in January of this year, being a bit more subtle.
Times have changed. The hobby has changed. People's opinions and commitments have changed. Sometimes what we want may not be seen as important by others, and sometimes it becomes easier to dismiss those needs than embrace the change people desire.
Now, I have some standing to identify with this position. I joined the NRC Board of Directors a few years ago, and I did my best to advocate for advancement in how the NRC operates its online websites. One of my intentions was to try to make these sites more accessible for sight-impaired members and others who download our audio. After receiving hostile pushback from the overseer of the sites, I resigned as a board member. What's sadly ironic about this is that the people who maintain the sites and provide the content are really good dudes who spend a lot of volunteer time on the written publications and the sites. My own quarrel was with the top-level direction, and I probably could have been a better advocate for change, but it is what it is, and I exercised my only option, as it appears Fred is now doing. Now, in fairness to this picture, you should be aware that the National Radio Club does provide some support to the DX Audio Service. The club manages subscriptions and dues payments and owns the duplicating equipment that produces the CDs. The club also handles postage costs and the cost of the musings line, everything but the production work itself. In my opinion, it would have been but a small additional step to demonstrate the kind of support that would have kept the DX Audio Service going. I can tell you that it was your support as listeners that made it worthwhile to continue to this point. So, here we are with the last issue of the DX Audio Service as an NRC publication. Might it continue in some other form? It's quite possible. Hopefully, Fred's voice and efforts may surface somewhere else. He, and in fact all of us, enjoy reading and producing audio stories for you. As Fred pointed out, he had hoped to keep the DXAS running for another 10 to 15 years. Anyway, that's the situation in April 2015, and who knows what the future will bring. You, dear listeners, will be the first to know, because Fred doesn't intend to lose contact. So back to work, and oh, before we forget, Mike Dugan, as patient as ever, dialed in a musing way back in January, following our profile of Twin Cities Radio, in which I mentioned an attorney was doing an air shift at station WWTC. Mike, my guess is that the attorney was Brian Short, who later, I believe, became a magistrate. At the time, his father, Bob Short, owned the station. I first met Brian after a fire at the WWTC transmitter. The Radio Rangers, our engineering group, responded to the call and found Brian already at work shoveling out the ashes. Made a good impression on me, since it's a bit unusual to see a lawyer, the owner's son, in the midst of the mess trying to help clean it up. Now, here's a snippet about sound. Sound is so important to all of us. This is a rebroadcast, an excerpt, actually, from the Friday version of All Things Considered on National Public Radio.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who have never...
Good evening. This is Admiral.
Serve your friends the beer with that new 1952 tape. Y'all to take
it. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
Today I also got a letter from Amy.
Friday brings us to Lost and Found Sound. It's our weekly excursion into the audio archives.
We hear things that people have chosen to record and save.
In our series, we've profiled people who are obsessed with sound, people like Tony Schwartz of New York City. Schwartz doesn't like to venture far from home, so he's only been recording sounds within his own zip code.
We've heard from Sam Phillips, the man who eventually recorded Elvis Presley, but who first relentlessly recorded the sounds and voices of Memphis. It was Sam Phillips who said, "It's just got to be that God's best creation is sound."
Then there is 85-year-old Don Hunter, who works out of his basement studio in Eugene, Oregon. His love affair with sound began in 1935.
I started out recording on RCA pre-groove discs, and shortly after that I got a professional 16-inch disc recorder and did public address jobs and sound recording and made recordings for radio broadcast. It was a 16-inch portable recorder, and it was heavy. It was a pretty heavy lug. I don't think I would do it these days. I eventually got a tape recorder in 1946 when I got back from service. I got the first tape recorder in town. It was a Brush sound mirror. It recorded on paper tape to begin with until they started putting out plastic.
In 1955, Don Hunter started making field recordings in stereo. Along the way, he founded and directed the University of Oregon's Audiovisual Media Center. He retired as professor emeritus in 1977. Today, his discs and tapes are his trophies, a few of which he has chosen to share with us for this series.
Of special interest to me during my career in audio and recording has been the collection of unusual sounds and the preservation of sounds around us, which are disappearing from our lives, often unnoticed. Sounds like fragrances evoke memories of past experiences. In a cabinet shop, a high-speed wood planer creates sounds in its dust exhaust pipe that resonate only at certain frequencies. When the planer motor is shut off, the resonating frequencies descend in harmonic sequence. As I grew up in the community of Eugene, Oregon, most families heated their homes with wood. Slab wood would be delivered in 4-foot lengths from Willamette Valley sawmills. It would be stacked by the cord in front of homes to season during the summer. Then, in the fall, the wood sawyer would be called in to cut the wood to furnace or fireplace lengths. He'd arrive with his horse-drawn wagon, which sported a wood cradle and a belt-driven saw powered by a one-cylinder Fairbanks Morse engine. In June of 1963, the melodious sound of a foghorn harmonizes with boat whistles on Lake Michigan near Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Sound which many of us hope will become a sound of the past in the remaining old-growth forest, felling a giant Douglas fir. Sound, and so much of the time we take it for granted. If we just open our ears, can get a lot more enjoyment in the world from taking in the whole scene, including sound.
Excerpts from the audio scrapbook of Oregon sound recordist Don Hunter.
Now, as a final sound tribute, here are the British Coldstream Guards and Black Watch from MacArthur Court at the University of Oregon in Eugene.
What else to report this month? Oh, a couple of news stories from Norway. Norway is ready to shut down the FM band as it's operated for decades, thanks to the reach of the European-developed out-of-band DAB Plus technology. Radio Magazine reports that Norway's National Communications Authority is officially ready to talk about sunsetting the FM band. That won't happen next week or next month, but public broadcaster NRK now covers 99.5% of the country's population, and the average of the commercial stations is about 93%. DAB Plus works outside the usual 88.1 to 107.9 FM band and offers more features than the original DAB system. This helpful translation of the Norwegian government's announcement shows that Norway is following the United Kingdom in digital radio switchover. There is a set of criteria, not dissimilar from the UK's. 50% of listening must be done digitally by 2015, and coverage should be equal to FM. Unlike the UK, the amount of DAB transmitters to cover Norway is about half the amount of FM ones. There are a few additional criteria. Inexpensive and technically satisfactory solutions for radio reception in cars must be available by early 2015, and if not, they'll delay switchover. This is sensible. The good news is that the SMMT in the United Kingdom reaffirmed their commitment to have DAB in all new cars by the end of 2013, so one would hope that this won't be an issue for the Norwegians. Finally, this interesting nugget. All tunnels above 500 meters in length, there are more than 500 of these in Norway, will get DAB installed by the Norwegian Road Authority, as the DAB system in the tunnels will double as an emergency warning system in case of accidents or fires. And again, we note that this DAB is not the digital audio IBOC proposed in the United States. Here's another AM-oriented story from Norway. It's called Norwegian Radio Enthusiast Picks Up OPB Signal. About a month ago, our station received a fascinating email. It came from a Norwegian man named Tor Jani Rotveit. He wrote, "I am one of those people who still really enjoys hunting for long-distance radio signals on the AM band. I am glad to tell you I was able to pick up the AM signals of KOAC in Arctic Norway." Rotveit sent us a recording of what he heard, and there's no mistake in our litany of OPB stations beamed more than 4,000 miles away. Rotveit, who says we can call him and TJ says the serendipity of the search is what makes collecting radio signals appealing. It's the same as for a hunter or fisher, says Brotveit. They know what they want, but they don't know what they'll get. Brotveit has been DXing since the early 1980s. DXers use receivers with computer software to collect the signals before reaching out to the stations with reception reports to verify what they picked up. Brotveit says he's collected signals through DXpeditions in Arctic Norway with other signal enthusiasts. During these trips, the group attempts to capture top-of-the-hour news at night and then review the recordings in the morning. In the light hours, the signals cannot get that very far because they follow the surface of the earth, he explained. When it becomes dark, the signal will go up into the atmosphere and be reflected, in theory, all around the globe. Brotveit says he has signals from all over the world, including all 50 U.S. states. Recently, he was able to tune into a station in Delaware, which apparently is hard to track down. Brotveit is blind and lives with his guide dog, Ani, outside the Norwegian city of Trondheim. And that news clip, called Norwegian Radio Enthusiast Picks Up OPB Signal, was written by Sage Von Wing and Lizzie Duffy. And so, before we sign off, let's see who's behind door two.
And now, reluctantly, as with all good things, we must now say a formal, final farewell. Take good care of yourself and your family, and hopefully our paths will cross once again in the near future.
Thanks, John. So good to hear your voice again. And behind door three? Well, we never could resist sharing a good laugh with you, and while we've played this before, it's a WCCO classic from two of our former workmates, Jürgen Nash and Maynard Spies on the Sunrisers show, and we thought it would be a great memory to leave with you.
Right now, the Twin Cities, 33 degrees, wind from the west, 14 miles an hour, the humidity is 69%, very light snow. The Weather Bureau radar indicates scattered light snow in the same location as at 5 a.m., therefore, please continue to use the summary...
which you threw in the wastebasket.
You should have thanked. Wait a minute, I got it. I got it.
Had it in our little round file here.
Wait, at 5 a.m., the Weather Bureau radar indicates some patchy light snow in extreme eastern Minnesota. Holy smoke, if they had said use the one given at 4, I tell you, I'd have had it, because it would have been down another foot down in the wastebasket. Jeez, those are getting very cagey over in the Weather Bureau.
Okay, all doors closed for now.
Happy trails to you.
Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Again. Until we meet again, good listening, DXers.
Happy trails to you.
Gee, that's pretty.
Audio, like it ought to be.
Now get your hands off that switch before you cut us off the...
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye.
The feds may reopen an investigation into the 1959 plane crash that killed Buddy Holly and three others. This story comes from various sources on March 4th of 2015. It was labeled the day the music died, but speculation has lived on about the cause of the airplane crash near Clear Lake that killed rock and roll legend Buddy Holly and three others in 1959. The Civil Aeronautics Board ruled on September 23, 1959, that the crash's cause was pilot error and deficiencies in the weather briefing to the pilot. But 56 years later, officials at the National Transportation Safety Board says its cold case unit is considering reopening the investigation. L.J. Kuhn, a New England man who describes himself as a retired pilot, aircraft dispatcher, and Federal Aviation Administrator Tess Proctor, petitioned the NTSB to look at several possible contributing factors that may clear the name of the pilot, Roger Peterson, who also died in the crash at age 21. "You have gotten our attention," the NTSB wrote to Kuhn on February 19, 2015. Promising to look into information that he provided. A decision on whether to reopen the case could take several weeks. Holly has become such a legend that for decades, legions of fans have flocked to the crash site 7 miles north of Clear Lake, where an annual party is held at the Surf Ballroom on the crash's anniversary. It's unclear what factors caused the NTSB to entertain reopening the case or how often the agency does so. Our cases are never closed, and we get these from time to time, said NTSB spokesperson Eric Weiss. The key is if there is new information not previously considered by the board. Kuhn said that via email that he investigated the crash to uncover information that could have saved lives in future flights. He mainly wants to know whether control may have been lost to inoperable right side rudder pedals and to inquire about readings on the fuel gauge. There was no fire after the crash or fuel smell reported at the site. I believe the NTSB will review Pilot Peterson's diagnostic actions in the aircraft during this 3.5-minute flight and realize the heroic efforts that took place in those 4.9 miles, Kuhn said. Those actions may have included trying to glide the plane to a landing and flare it just before its right wing hit the ground, causing the plane to tumble and crash. The Dwyer Flying Service hired Peterson for the flight and later faced a lawsuit from the family of Richie Valens, who was also killed, along with fellow musician J.P., the Big Bopper Richardson. I disagree with the gentleman, said Barb Dwyer of Clear Lake, who worked at the service with her husband Jerry, who is suffering health problems. They come out of the woodwork this time of the year with their theories. The events of that February 3, 1959 night have been the subject of numerous books. Dion DiMucci of Dion and the Belmonts told the Register in 2009 that Buddy Holly told musicians that night to flip a coin to see who would fill the three seats of the four-seat Beechcraft Bonanza aircraft after the concert at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake and who would have to go on the bus. But Waylon Jennings, then a young bass player who would later find fame in country music, gave up his one seat to Richardson, who was battling a fever. After the airplane crash, the guilt over the decision would dog Jennings for the rest of his life. In the months and years that followed, speculation abounded about the discovery of a gun at the crash site, rumors of disputes between the musicians and others matters. Light snow was falling with gusty winds when the plane took off and flew to a remote area of darkness where there was no definite horizon, requiring the pilot to rely solely on flight instruments that he was not experienced with, according to the accident report. A key part of the aeronautic board findings, Kuhn said, was that the right wing hit the ground with the nose lowered only slightly, indicating that some control was being affected at the time. Another factor may have been an improper weight distribution on the airplane, which would cause the plane to be more difficult to control. Urbandale author Larry Lemmer said that he studied the in-depth investigation file for the crash while compiling his book, The Day the Music Died, and is convinced the pilot suffered vertigo. The pilot was not qualified to fly on instruments at all, he said. When you get flying in that remote part of the state, there isn't much ground reference, and it's hard to tell up from down. Jerry Dwyer told the Register in 2009 that he would clear up the factors behind the crash by supplying new information in a book. Barb Dwyer declined further comment on the forthcoming book or the crash. This has been Feds May Reopen the Investigation into the 1959 plane crash that killed Buddy Holly and three others. This story comes from various sources on March 4th, 2015. I'm Fred Vobey for the DX Audio Service.
On the January 2015 DX Audio Service, I brought you the news of longtime KSCS morning personality Terry Dorsey's retirement from radio. On March the 7th, Terry Dorsey passed away at his retirement home in Illinois. Here's more from WFAA-TV's Marie Saveda.
Troy Aikman, holy smoke, what are you doing calling?
My years in Dallas started with Dorsey and the gang. I can't believe this is it.
Terry Dorsey, legendary radio host, has passed away just 3 months after he retired. Our partner, the Star-Telegram, was in the studio for Dorsey's last show on KSCS in December. He received a lot of love that morning from big-name country stars and local fans alike. Well, tonight, those same listeners are remembering a man known for his broadcasting talent and his big heart.
And this was the greatest gift you could ever give somebody.
On the morning of December 17th, the only place to be was with Terry Dorsey for the final moments of a 46-year career.
It's a bittersweet time. I'm going to miss this, but I'm looking forward to sleeping in.
The Dallas radio legend spent 26 years at KSCS, side by side with Mark Hawkeye Lewis, earning adoring fans. And on this day, he was ready for the next chapter.
Everybody that he's ever worked with over the last 30 years was here. And, you know, who would have thought that a little more than 2 months later, it would all be over.
In retirement, Dorsey moved with his wife to farmland in Illinois. And that is where his family says he died suddenly Saturday night after a few days of not feeling well.
Devastated, shocked by it. Our staff just crushed by the news.
They had hoped that Dorsey would get a long, relaxed retirement, where he'd be farming, like he always said.
We'll never forget you, and you'll be with us in spirit every single day.
Instead, KSCS family and fans now feel grateful that they got to give Dorsey the goodbye he deserved.
And now I don't want to go on blubbering, but it's been great.
While he was still around to hear it.
Terry Dorsey never had a bad day, and that kind of attitude really rubbed off on people, and it was not only a great talent, but a great human being, and that's really the biggest loss.
Even after his retirement, the morning show on KSCS bears Dorsey's name. And tomorrow morning, Hawkeye is planning the entire show as a tribute to him. So be sure to tune in to hear and even share your favorite Dorsey memories.
That's right, Marie. Country musicians including Pat Green, Brad Paisley, and Joe Don Rooney of Rascal Flatts call into the Hawkeye and Dorsey show to share memories. And local media personalities such as WFAA Channel 8's Ron Corning and Alexa Konomos dropped in, as did former members of the Dorsey gang, such as Rebecca Carroll, who was known as Rebecca, and Brother Van. But many of the memories belong to Mark Hawkeye Lewis, who worked side-by-side with Dorsey for 26 years, till Dorsey's retirement in December, and to the show's producer of 4 years, Trapper John Morris. We kept his name on the show, Lewis said at the beginning of the show. We weren't ready to put it to rest just yet. There will always be a little Terry Dorsey in here, Morris added. Lewis said that he received a call Saturday evening, March the 7th, from Dorsey's stepdaughter, giving him the news, but that he and the station were asked not to announce anything until Sunday morning because the family wanted to make sure all of Dorsey's relatives were notified. The station posted Lewis's announcement of Dorsey's death just a little before noon on Sunday. He was at home, Lewis said. His wife had just talked to him a few minutes before, and she was cooking him dinner. She walked back into the kitchen, and her daughter came out to say something to Terry, and he had passed away. It had been like 10 minutes. It was that fast. It was that sudden. It was that peaceful. From Dallas, Texas, I'm Wally Warrow for the DX Audio Service.
Study shows that farmers still rely on farm radio. This article was published on March the 9th, 2015, by the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. A study by IPSOS Research for the National Association of Farm Broadcasting says farmers still rely on farm format radio, with strong listening from the morning through the close of the markets. The study conducted during the 2014 harvest said that 84% of the respondents called local farm radio broadcasting and information, quote, an important factor in their daily operation decisions, unquote. Among the reasons given for listening were getting prices, following the markets, getting local information, news, weather, and convenience. NAFB Director Tom Brand said, there is a strong connection to the everyday tasks of farmers and ranchers to perform the daily programming of farm broadcasting. Our member stations and networks develop programming based on the audience needs in their listening area. That is the power of radio and farm broadcasting. If you would like to read the PDF report for yourself, just go to www.dxas.org/farm, F-A-R-M, all small letters. The report from the NAFB contains some graphics, so you may have to have a sighted person translate the results for you. I'm Fred Volbe, out in my field for the DX Audio Service.
The FCC may close two-thirds of its field offices. The agency's managing director, John Wilkins, and Enforcement Bureau Chief Travis LeBlanc recommended drastic cuts in a new memo sent to the 8th floor, slashing the number of field director positions from 21 to 5, cutting the number of field agents in half from 63 to 33, and turning out the lights at 16 of the current 24 field offices. That would leave just New York City, Chicago, Atlanta, Miami, Dallas, L.A., San Francisco, and the office nearest the FCC itself, Columbia, Maryland. The cutback memo was revealed by Radio World, whose Leslie Stimson quickly produces a follow-up about how industries are nervous about the potential field office closures. True, there's less need by radio folks at the regional level because of self-certification and compliance programs run by state associations. But there's worry about the role the FCC plays in refereeing interference cases in wireless and public service communications. Though for radio, there's a nagging issue in places like Boston, New York, and South Florida. Pirates on the FM radio band. How would the New York regional office handle a reported pirate in Boston's Roxbury neighborhood? The NAB's Dennis Wharton says the idea is potentially troubling, particularly as the FCC begins encouraging spectrum sharing among different types of communication services. Here's the story referenced in our report. Industry nervous about potential FCC field office closures by Leslie Stimson of Radio World magazine. Broadcasters, as well as the wireless industry and public service communications, such as police and fire agencies, depend on the FCC field offices, though how much varies. Several that have heard about the FCC's proposal to close many of its Enforcement Bureau field offices are worried. Field agents serve a valuable role, particularly in interference situations, said one broadcast source, in a market where the field office is slated for closure. Another broadcast source downplayed how much stations have contact with the Enforcement Bureau because of volunteer inspections and self-certification, notwithstanding the occasional fence or public file fine. Where the field offices really come into play, according to this source, is refereeing interference cases, with many of those related to non-broadcast industries, like wireless or wired phone or public service communications. Indeed, a wireless industry source from a market where the field office is slated for closure said his industry relies on the FCC a lot for interference mitigation. Only they have the enforcement credentials to shut down interference we get into our wireless base stations, he tells Radio World, noting that the issue is prevalent with the amount of cellular booster devices, blocking devices, and amplifiers in the market. Many of these devices are sold for U.S. consumer use in their homes to improve cell service. However, the devices can generate interference if they're not properly installed, causing interference to base stations, he tells Radio World. Several broadcast engineers who contacted Radio World are worried about the effect that closing some field offices would have on the agency's efforts to track down pirates. Agencies have special movable direction finding equipment for that. Such gear is probably going to be missing from some markets. I don't know what their plan is to tamp pirate activity down if that equipment is taken away, said one broadcast source, in a market slated for field office closure. Representatives of some of the affected industries are discussing their next step, such as potentially lobbying Congress to keep the field offices open, Radio World has heard. I'm Phil Wayne in Harpster, Ohio. Maybe I'll hear you on the air, as pirate radio has a chance to flourish.
And finally on part one, the death of CDs. Vinyl is the future at record stores, by Matt Miller in the magazine Hey Reverb. If the CD isn't dead already, its days are certainly numbered at record stores. While looking through the year-end figures for 2014, Paul Epstein, owner of Denver's Twist and Shout Records, noticed something he hasn't seen in 25 years. Gross dollar sales of vinyl records has surpassed that of CDs. There's a romance with vinyl now, Epstein said. For years, millions of people have swapped convenience for aesthetics, and in some crazy cultural way, they all woke up and realized they had nothing, and their music means nothing, and iPods suck, and they want to get back to the music and caring about it. The last 5 years have seen vinyl sales increasing year after year, with CD sales sliding. Through the first half of 2014, CD sales dropped 19.6%, while LP and vinyl sales increased 40.4% nationally, according to Nielsen SoundScan reports. In 2013, more than 6 million vinyl LPs were sold, up 33% from 4.5 million in 2012. Vinyl is becoming the format of choice for the true music fan, said Mark Mulligan, a music analyst from MIDIA Research. Their view of the CD is Cher's greatest hits in Walmart, and it's the lowest common denominator for music, he said. On vinyl, it's sort of a mystical thing from the past. Vinyl's profitability has always surpassed that of CDs, the capitalistic equivalent of empty calories, said Epstein. But there's also a much harder to obtain, being less plentiful, and there's no return of vinyl to manufacturers. They take up more space and, on the use side, require arcane knowledge to acquire the correct records, Epstein said. Andy Schneidkraut, owner of Albums on the Hill in Boulder, Colorado, first noticed this crossover in CD and vinyl gross dollar sales in June of 2013. And since that month, vinyl sales left CDs in the dust, he said. Angelo CDs and More, which sells CDs and vinyl at multiple locations in the Denver metro area, hasn't reached this crossover yet. However, the store is speeding ever so closer to seeing the vinyl pass CDs, said owner Angelo Corino. It might even happen by next year, he said. In part, it's because vinyl LPs cost more. Twist and Shout's top-selling LP of 2014, Jack White's Lazaretto, and Beck's Morning Phase, both released last year, cost $28.99 and $24.99, respectively. On CDs, both sell for $12.99. It's a trend that many won't have anticipated after the CD was introduced in the 1980s, and decades later, digital music and streaming services. Audiophiles buy vinyl for the improved sound quality. Many people buy Jack White's album for its bonus features, but more importantly, it fills the physical void for owning music. During the great digital shift in the year 2000, an entire generation suddenly neglected the physical ownership of music. When you listen to a record, you have a relationship with the music. You sit down and have a common connection to it, said Schneidkraut. And he says they want it to matter. They want an emotional connection. Records require a commitment that CDs and digital music never did. An image on your phone or tablet or desktop still doesn't replace the feeling of holding an album and proudly displaying it on your shelf. For young music fans coming to age in the digital world, that physical aspect is something that they want to experience. In an era where everything is vanilla, where everything is available at the swipe of a finger, nothing is special anymore, Mulligan said. Music fans are trying to find something that's special, and vinyl are special, and record stores are putting vinyl back into the equation of what makes music special again. With these sales and the cultural trend of customers choosing vinyl instead of CDs, record shops are changing. Twist and Shout, Albums on the Hill, Angelo's, and Wax Trax in Denver are all shifting their shelf space to represent the consumer's growing desire for LPs. Anybody who shops here regularly has noticed that the West Room has gone from 50% vinyl to 100% vinyl and is now in the East Room, and back a couple of rows haven't been converted yet to vinyl, Epstein said of Twist and Shout. It's been a massive amount of change at our store. At Wax Trax in Denver, owner Dave Wilkins said the record shop is in the process of moving its 45s to a neighboring CD store to have more room for vinyl LPs. Albums on the Hill will cut back the number of used CDs that it keeps on shelves. Angelo's has been steadily decreasing the CD selection and growing its vinyl, and will continue to do so through 2015. Even if it's a fad, and even if it passes, this is what shows us that music fans have an inherent hunger for a tangible manifestation of their music taste, Mulligan said. They want something they can touch and feel and say, this is who I am. This has been The Death of CDs, Vinyl is the Future at Record Stores, by Matt Miller in the magazine Hey Reverb. Reverb managing editor Matt Miller has a real common name, so just send him an email at mrmiller@denverpost.com.
On a boat in a tree, on the beach at Waikiki, keep a radio with you so your ears can see.
Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service, a nonprofit organization devoted to the radio listening hobby.